All right, we are going to start the next session. So I am delighted to present Stephen Kesselman from the University of Manitoba. And he is going to present on language vitality, health and well-being in Cree and Ojibwa communities in Manitoba. Thank you very much, Stephen, for coming.
Thanks very much. The title has shifted slightly.
I'm just looking
at an Ojibwa community right now, but otherwise accurate. So good morning. Aloha, Bujo, thank you all for coming. It's great to see everybody here. It's actually great to be in this room too, because it's such a beautiful and inspiring setting. I thought I left out when I said. So my name is Steve Kesselman. I'm from Winnipeg, Manitoba. I'm a grad student at the University of Manitoba, and part of my master's work is in surveying linguistic health in the northern Ojibwa community of Manitoba. It's in the very preliminary stages of the project, so I'm just going to speak to the aims and the aesthetic and the design of the survey right now and how it differs from past vitality descriptions and assessments from around the world. This is a picture of the namesake of the community that I'm working in, Poplar River, for Poplar River First Nation. And my acquaintance with the community was actually by way, not of academia, but of a canoe trip where I, by happenstance, passed through there. But that's a whole other story that I won't get into, because I'll talk about it for the next book. Okay, so a little background about Poplar River. It's a community in the north basin of Lake Winnipeg, it's where that red dot is, about 500 kilometers north of Winnipeg. It has about 1,200 residents, so it's quite small, most of whom are Ojibwa with some Métis Nation and also some Cree, because it's on the periphery of the Ojibwa continuum, and so it borders a number of Cree communities, namely Norway House, which is at the north end of Lake Winnipeg. It's part of the Ojibwe continuum and represents the northwestern dialect of that continuum, which by different accounts has between 6 and 7 named dialects stretching over a large area of the Algonquin continuum from southwest Quebec all the way through the Great Lakes area and all the way into Saskatchewan. According to the Igaveni, it's right at 7 or shifting. This type of surveying vitality is a departure from this rating, and I'll get to that in a bit. But first, I think it's worthwhile to mention Sophia Ravdalskis and the Matronaki World Heritage Project. Sophia is my main go-to person and contact and facilitator, mentor, inspiration on the ground in Poplar River. And she, for the last 2 decades or so, has been involved in the Matronaki Land That Gives Life Heritage Project, which is a bid to get a large chunk of land on the east side of Lake Winnipeg, about 35,000 square kilometers, named to the UNESCO list of protected World Heritage Sites. And I find that worthwhile to mention, just for those of us that saw Dr. Taft's plenary at the beginning of this conference, she mentioned the differing definitions of health and of language that different people and cultures around the world have, and the idea that land, language, and culture are oftentimes, and probably more often than not, 3 things that are inextricably linked. And to speak of one is necessarily to speak of the other. It can't be seen in isolation. And so this project and this community and Sophia and all the Poplar River First Nation people embody and represent this ideology. So it's something to keep in mind when we're talking about discussing linguistic health. Okay, yeah, so this is the Ojibwa continuum. You can see how it stretches from southwest Quebec through to Saskatchewan, with outliers in a number of communities in the south and the west, largely due to that blemish of forest relocation that our histories share, and Poplar River's on that northwest periphery there. Okay, so our survey project. 3 main motivating questions behind this survey project is the what, how, and the why of describing linguistic health. So these are the types of questions that define and delimit the type of project that's going to be undertaken. So the what being what's guiding this description, what are the theoretical underpinnings, and how is that defined by your approach, how you're going to be doing it, and how is that in turn defined by the why. So the purpose is going to kind of delimit and constrain and dictate how you're going to approach it and what your framework is going to be. So our framework is defined by the limits presented by the LVE, which is the language vitality and endangerment factors of UNESCO that were made in 2003, and the IGIDS framework. And the main limitations of these being that since our purpose is to describe the linguistic health of this community from the eyes and the perceptions and the beliefs and values of the people of Poplar River First Nation, in the effort to build a description that represents them and their beliefs and their values, the certain limits of these frameworks that are properly employed are that they are largely static. There's not a lot of room for the voice of the community. There's not a lot of room to describe variation within the community, but mainly that the character and the voices of the people are not represented by these frameworks. So we modified our framework, which we'll get to shortly, to cater to our approach, which is a survey method, a bottom-up approach, and one that is informed solely by what is provided from the community. So we wanted to design the survey so that it is not meant to inform or reinforce or cater to or conform to existing vitality descriptions, such as kids ratings, and one that doesn't describe the language based on its possibility or potential to shift. And then the secondary goal is to consider linguistic vitality in terms of determinants of health. So with an increasing recognition that many disparities in health in Canada and Manitoba and around the world are due to social determinants, what is the role that language can play that at the community level? So our framework, it looks similar to the LVE framework with a couple adaptations. The first is that we remove documentation because the number of grammars or the number of papers published on inanimate transitivity does not have a lot of bearing on an individual's relationship or the majority of individuals' relationship in the community itself. So we took it out of our framework. We consolidated numbers based on the size of the community to just look at proportional numbers. Attitudes were consolidated to represent both community and official attitudes in the community, and domains looking at all means. So we redefined materials in the vitality and endangerment factors of UNESCO. Materials just looks at raw numbers of what's available for educational purposes. We looked at access to educational materials to introduce some factor of dynamics to it. So we can look at not only how many materials are available, but whether people access them, how often they use them, and what purposes they're serving. And then the biggest things we added were programs and knowledge. So ongoing and planned programs was added to introduce another aspect of dynamics to it, to add a factor of potential for change within the community as the relationship with language grows or changes, and knowledge to further inform self-reports, but also to use as a comparison with the other factors. So we can look at relative degrees of knowledge in terms of differing attitudes, or relative degrees of knowledge in terms of age groups and how that relates to the domains that it's being used in. Okay, so the survey itself is divided into four sections, which is background, attitudes, Ojibwe in the community, which is functions and domains and patterns of use in the community, and language knowledge. And the point here to see in our design of the survey questions is that they are proportionately targeting certain factors based on our purpose of the survey, which is to represent the beliefs in the community and the use in the community, so they're proportionately targeting certain factors. So it involves a sort of reordering of the importance of vitality factors. You can see how we reordered them there compared to how they are ordered in previous frameworks such as the LVE. Yeah, so an example of how we're targeting factors, for instance, in section two, our attitudes and beliefs, here are three examples of what those questions are. The first would be a more Likert type scale of questions, and the last one being a list or a short answer. And the important thing to take away from here is that when we're targeting factors, we're not seeing those factors as monolithic things. We're looking at targeting the nuances of those factors. So within those 14 or 15 attitudes questions, we're trying to isolate and tease out the nuances of the factors of attitudes. So for instance, the first question there is looking to tease out information regarding their attitudes towards relative prestige or practicality of the language that they use. The second being one that's more geared toward their ideas towards purity or ownership or exclusivity toward the language within the community. And the last one being perceptions regarding reasons for engagement, so that you get a more detailed and nuanced picture of attitudes as opposed to just a positive versus a negative description. The survey also has variety of styles, from table style such as this one to multiple choice, yes, no, short answer. The introduction of a style such as this, the table style, is particularly helpful for our purposes because it can, mainly the fact that it introduces a bit of interest to the survey, so that it's not just a monotonous, boring task that people are being asked to finish, but it also has the ability to target multiple factors and multiple indicators of vitality. So for instance, this question, which looks at domains and functions of use within the community, also teases out information regarding materials, whether newspapers are available, whether restaurant menus are available, whether there's radio programs available, but also attitudes such as, do they exist, but do you want them? Do you not care? Things like that. So it makes the survey more efficient in that sense. And then the main innovation of this survey was the language knowledge section. The benefit and the reason we wanted to introduce this was to avoid a dichotomized speaker-based description. So a description of the speaker-based that suggests speaker versus non-speaker, which is, at least in Canada, what we tend to get with our national household surveys or our censuses, especially with our previous government, which shortened the census to something that was just bare bones. And for two of our past three surveys, we just got information based on self-reporting, whether or not individuals thought that they were speakers. So this informs self-reported abilities, but also allows us to have a nuanced description of variation across the community. So we can look at relative abilities based on age group. You can look at relative abilities based on age group and based on what their attitudes are. Relative abilities based on where they say they use the language. And you get a much more detailed description of what language use in that community looks like. However, there are a number of challenges in introducing this type of section into the survey. And these are challenges that can kind of be extended to the survey style and the survey method overall. The first one being issues of dialect. There's not a ton of resources in the Northwestern dialect specifically of Ojibwe. Despite it being a highly mutually intelligible dialect with surrounding dialects, such as the dialect spoken in even as far south as Minnesota, there's the possibility for difficulty in understanding between people. So people that are more familiar with certain dialects might have an easier time filling up this section. And we try to avoid that by consulting a great deal with Sophia and with people in the community to ensure that our language knowledge section would be understandable. Part of it has a literate bias. So Ojibwe is written in syllabics, but also what's called a double vowel written system, which is Roman orthography using double vowels for long vowels. And so while a lot of learning Ojibwe speakers are familiar with the system, or they're taught this double vowel system, many might not be, especially in an isolated community like Popular or First Nation. So for that reason, in addition to language knowledge questions that are written, we have audio language knowledge questions as well. And then the main challenge here and the concern for the survey overall is the potential for negative impact on participants. So this is impacting self-esteem, the perception that we're passing judgment, the perception that there are right and wrong answers, the perception that they are misrepresenting themselves, their culture, their people. And so particular care and attention needs to be taken when formulating these questions and formulating the survey overall. And that comes from exhaustive consultations with the community and with Sophia. So this language knowledge session comes in three styles of questions, not four, that vary in their content and style and difficulty. So there's written translations, audio translations, where they'll hear something and ask to translate it, and then comprehension, which will be asking something about the passage. So for instance, they'll be given something like this, and have the option to say, I cannot translate this, or write how they would have said it differently in Popular or First Nation. And so that's sort of a mid-range difficulty question. So we'll either ask them to translate that, or translate as much as they can, or ask certain questions like, what happened at 2 o'clock? Where did you go this afternoon? How many stores did you go to? Just to tease out if they can't translate everything word for word, if they have a certain degree of understanding of the question. And then there's also the audio question. So for those of us who have never heard Ojibwe, or Northwestern, Ojibwe for that matter, they're, here we go. They'll be given something like
this. Wabun Zenz Nindau, Nindishnikas Niki, Ninda Minbanakazing.
Ziguam, Nimino Wendan, Jib Bakweje Gidoyan, Wabigwini.
Nimbaba Minijakawak, Mimenwak, Mimenwak, Nimbaba Minijakago.
Nibing, Nimen Wendan, Je Anwelian, Gijigateng, Minwa, Wamagwa, Beneship.
And so in the same vein, they'll all be asked to translate as much or part of that as they can. That's a part of a story called I Am a Bunny by Ole Rusom, which I really like. There's a picture book that goes with it, which I could include there. And so that's kind of the easy to mid-range difficulty too, but they'll also be given something like this, which is a poem by Dr. Margaret Mudin, who works at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And so she wrote this poem and she's allowing us to use it in the survey, and it's quite beautiful, so I'm going to play it for you too.
Chigami shkitoya bagasindamya, jivaigamigong namaya chikeya, wenesh wajwebak pi basadengak kanan, pi nabishinsan mitigansvit, Pigo koshak tawagak zitagani. Mamwe mahjong na nishnave moya mira neseya.
So the idea being between the written translations, the comprehension, and the varying difficulty, and the audio translations and comprehension, we can get a picture. There's something that somebody can latch on to show their proficiency or ability in the language, mm-hmm. and we can get a bit of a description of their abilities. And then the last thing I want to mention, is where this project could potentially fit in a greater discussion of understanding what the relationship between language and health and well-being is. So first, this varies in Canada, Manitoba, and many parts of this part of the world can be largely attributed to these three major factors. And then there are significant determinants that are unique to indigenous populations, being these five factors. Compiled by Dr. Postal, who's the Dean of Medicine at the University of Manitoba School of Medicine, which I'm not familiar with other schools of medicine, but at least in Manitoba, there's an increasing shift in direction in the curriculum toward understanding health in terms of these social determinants. So they're doing well that way. I'd be curious to see how other schools are reacting. So I highlighted cultural continuity here, because this is where I think language most evidently plays a role, however, it is certainly connected to all the other factors. And so it is sort of the hypothesis and where I'd like to take this type of survey to see what role can this type of survey and the information it provides, what can it play in understanding the components of linguistic health, how they relate to the components of social determinants that affect health. So Cameron Malone identified these seven cultural or factors of cultural continuity. And in their work in 1998, and in subsequent work since then, in 2009, I think, by Chandler and Hallett on the West Coast, noted that language, above and beyond all the other factors, has a predictive power to see, or to say what health comes in a community might be. So the question being, what are the components of linguistic health that can be teased out by this survey that relate to these cultural continuity factors? And so this is the possibility that we're coming up with, that the components of linguistic health are predictive, or make language in a community predictive of health outcomes by the way they relate to other factors of cultural continuity. So self-determination land games can be analogous to attitudes and belief, education, cultural facilities, related to programs, materials, knowledge of the language, and domains and functions. Health services, police and fire, what's available in the community. Right, so the next steps I want to take with this, which may be a bit premature because we're still waiting on the return of the surveys and this description of the community, but is to extend this type of method of analysis to other communities in Manitoba and along the Algonquin continuum to see whether linguistically similar communities or communities that have been designated the same EGIDS rating of shift or same UNESCO LVE rating what the underlying character of these superficially similar communities looks like and how they might differ once you dive into them a bit. And then use these community-specific descriptions of linguistic health to explore this relation between language and health outcomes in communities and try and understand determinants of health, or try and understand components of linguistic health in terms of determinants of cultural or public and community health. So I'd just like to finish by acknowledging my gratitude for the following Paupuri First Nation and Zafaya, Margaret Bittern, who is an education director in Paupuri First Nation, Dr. Margaret Newton, whose poems she graciously let me use, Nicole Rosen in the University of Manitoba, all of you at ICLDC and UHU NOAA, and here's that link to Maturina Key, our old heritage project. I would encourage all of you to check out. And this is a teepee at Paupuri First Nation that, that we stayed in London. Thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'd be delighted.
So we have 9 minutes for questions.
I'm just wondering if we could access and look at the survey.
Yeah, it's not live yet. And I'm wondering how I could distribute it once we do make it live. But yeah, if you'd like to have a look at the survey, I can certainly provide it to you.
Yeah, we're in the process of building one to collect data.
Okay.
And sort of having access to something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I think we're going to make it available through the University of Manitoba website, the Department of Linguistics website. So once it is live and available to the community, then it'll be accessible there. Yeah.
I'm not sure whether I saw it right. In some of the samples of the questions for your survey, you had disagree, agree. So that's a binary. Do they have just a yes, no answer possibility, or was it a graded?
Right, no, I just wrote disagree, disagree. It's actually gonna be a 5-point, or it is a 5-point Likert scale, so it goes from strongly disagree, agree, unsure, disagree, strongly disagree. So it's a 5-point Likert scale. Which will lend itself a bit more easily to quantifying and statistical analysis.
I have a question. Who's administering the survey?
That's a great question. Yeah. So part of our approach and our aesthetic is that it's steeped within the community and it's going to be a part of certain cultural or community centers and stuff. So the survey is going to be located primarily in the school. So certain educators are going to be incorporating into classroom activities. It's also going to be in the youth center there and the elders lodge there. So the idea being to attract as many people from varying demographics within the community. So from the kids at the school, that'd be K to grade 10 or 9. People at the youth center, which is everybody, and then the elders lodge where they have access to a computer and people that can help them.
How about the parents of the school children?
Yeah, well, I mean, they have to sign off on it, for one.
But would they be respondents to the survey as well?
Hopefully, yeah. Yeah, so the idea being that kids can take this idea home and have their parents work on it, too. The trouble with, especially in a community like Paupuri First Nation, that it's quite isolated, and there's not a ton of resources up there. So the finding a computer and internet to do it, those are mostly in the school or the youth center or the elders lodge. So you had to locate them in certain community locales where kind of people can come to and do it together.
How about the analog way to do it?
You have to go up there and
no paper,
we were talking about, you know, it's the year 2017, we've got technology.
Yeah.
I'm certainly going to be going up there to talk to the survey, the reason for it again, and then afterward to follow up with people about it. Yeah, but the actual filling out of the survey, I think it's, we'll get the most people doing it if you do it online.
Okay.
So you are not allowing for elaboration, so for more qualitative.
We are.
So you agree or disagree with whether you're 4 or 3, but why, under which circumstances?
We are. I wish I could have shown more questions in the survey, but after almost every single question, there's opportunity to elaborate. So there's space for people to write in their comments, and especially at the end of the surveys, space to write in their comments. The survey has short answer questions, it also has more longer answer questions. And almost every single one, like you said, yes, allows for more qualitative evaluative answers over how they felt about the question, and if they wanted to add anything more, or if they thought the question was lacking or leaving in some way.
How many people do you anticipate filling out the survey in the community? Do you have a goal, or?
As much as possible. So the school has about 200 kids in it. If we get all of them, that would be wonderful. I don't anticipate that. The community itself is 1,200. That includes surrounding areas of people that don't live in Poplar River, the confines of the community itself. So if we can get between 200 and 300 people, you know, the kids and their parents, and then a number of the elders, of which there are not a ton, but a few, then that would be ideal.
Do you think it might be detrimental in the sense of getting less participants that you have a test on it, on linguistic knowledge? Once they say, oh, you know, and at the end of the survey, you have to do translations, and, you know, maybe you get a grade, especially in school or something,
yeah.
In a place like that, I could imagine that maybe some students then don't want to participate. Or,
yeah,
you know.
It's a huge concern, and we tried to address that by incorporating the survey into like classroom activities. So if they're going to be doing work anyways, we tried to make it as fun as possible, including different types of questions, different content in the translation, audio, written, but also the fact that they'll be in language classes, so it might be some sort of assignment they're doing already, then they could just do this and have that be part of the assignment. But yeah, it's certainly a concern if somebody asks me to do a test voluntarily.
With the other generation, with the elders, they are all fully bilingual in English, or do they get a translation into?
They're all fully bilingual in English, everyone there. All of the elders there have a history in residential schooling. So that's the other sensitive aspect of a survey like this, is they learned their language. They're L1 Ojibwe speakers that were forced to give up their language from a very, very young age and are reclaiming it slowly since, you know, the last 20, 30 years. So they are fully bilingual speakers, which is helpful because they kind of act as the standard for the community that everything kind of will be compared to.
I have another question.
Yeah.
Were the Ojibwe in Canada relocated? Or is that their
yes.
ancestral homeland that you showed us on the
That
map?
Is their ancestral homeland. There was relocations from there to more urban centers,
mm-hmm.
historically in the residential schooling, and then repatriation back to communities. Yeah, that.
So following up on that, one of your slides, and I don't remember which one it was, at the bottom you had like six factors. It might have been the medical school. There it was.
Yep.
Yeah. I think that the connectivity to land should probably be bolded as well as the cultural continuity.
Absolutely.
Because of this dislocation and relocation issue.
Mm-hmm.
The experience that I have working with Native North American populations in the U.S. is there is this strong sense that we were removed from our lands, so that it's very hard to keep connected to cultural continuity.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Correct. And I think while there is progress within institutions like medical institution,
mm-hmm.
and that's an important one for there to be progress in, they've got a long way to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm amazed that that's what the School of Medicine is.
Well, Manitoba is a part, we have one of the largest disparities in health between, proportionately we have one of the biggest populations of indigenous people in our province. Not the biggest by numbers, but proportionate to other populations.
Right.
And so, and the disparities in our province are one of the biggest in the country. And so, Dr. Posak is actually an amazing person. He did tons of work up north in Churchill. And so when he took over at the school about 5 years ago, this is when this shift and this increasing recognition of these factors started to take hold.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's great to see, and I hope
yeah.
other schools start to
I've
shift in
that
direction
that
as well.
I'm
yeah.
impressed, yeah.
yeah. And it's largely because we have such, I mean, it's too bad that it's because we have such a big problem that the shift
right.
is taking place, but hopefully we can act as
yeah.
a sort of something to emulate.
Yeah. Any more questions? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.